All right, last week was fun. We made that fun Ming-Chi Kuo note to talk about, in which he predicted a whole range of new Macs, and we kind of zoomed in on MacBook Pros as one area of interest for us. And I think it was quite fun, the things we discussed, like, you know, with the new keyboard, would that MacBook have keyboard issues? Like, would it be part of the program? What might this new display technology mentioned for the iMac be? And then no sooner than we could release the episode, Apple flipped the switch on new MacBook Pros that kind of answered a lot of those questions for us, I think.
At least some of them,
yeah. And I threw in a last-minute update just to give listeners context as to when we were recording, because we usually do like Wednesday night, and then on Thursday morning we try to put the show out. And it was Thursday morning in the middle of summer when Apple released all these new MacBook Pros. And then they were in stores the next day. And it's a real MacBook Pro update. Like, and if you we'll get into the specifics, but just in terms of like the timing, the first MacBook Pro of this style was at an October event, right?
Yes.
Like it was a big deal. It was part of an event. And I think it was worthy because it was a new design and a lot of changes to it. The next one...
And the touch bar, like, people discredit the touch bar, but that was like Apple's big thing, right?
That's true.
There's clearly a lot of implementation work behind it, and they wanted to get developers on board. They had those demos where the guy was DJing on the touch bar. Like, all of that stuff, it was like a big keynote show, like, perfect material for it.
Right, exactly. And then the next year, so that was October. It wasn't the iPhone event, right? It was like its own event in October?
Yeah, it was the month after.
Okay. So then the next year, they update them sooner than 12 months. So it was less than a year turnaround time. It was WWDC 2017, and they were updating a lot of Macs at the time, including MacBook Pros. And it was like, it was just part of the event. It was and then this year WWDC came and there were no updates. We weren't at the October point yet, but a month after WWDC, in the middle of the week, early in the morning, they just released, you know, updates to the 13-inch MacBook Pro with Touch Bar and 15-inch MacBook Pro with Touch Bar. And I would say if people weren't so focused on the keyboard, I think this would be a pretty big deal. Like, it'd be a big splash, because it sounds like, to me on the surface, it's like these updates are what people wanted to see 2 years ago, and now it's there, you know, give or take some points like ports and you know, that kind of thing. But
I mean, it's not a case redesign. So if you had niggles or disappointments with the 2016 case, you're not really getting your questions answered here. But as we discussed last week, the turnaround time, if you really think that Apple saw the reaction to the 2016 model and started working on a brand new, you know, revision that tried to cater more to that market, you know, the 3 year life cycle, we're not there yet. Like, this is the second small revision.
And we don't know if that even happened or has happened.
Yeah, we don't even know if it even happened. Like, we're just assuming there's an iMac Pro style laptop in the wings, but
maybe
they very well might not be.
Yeah. but the big thing that was 32 gigabytes of RAM being an option on the 15-inch model. But that's what, like, even though 16 gigabytes was always the max amount on MacBook Pros, even in 2016, people were like, where's the 32 gigabyte option now? Because it was a new style, I guess. People wanted that. And I guess it was a thing in other laptops.
And it'd been so many years of the same size, because I think everyone was like hoping on the case redesign to bring the jump in RAM. And when it didn't come, there was a lot of backlash and disappointment with it. Because the 2012 Retina MacBook Pro, which is what I had before the 2016, that had 16 gigabytes of RAM as an option. And then with the 2016s, the 16 became base model, but they didn't offer an upgrade. And, you know, this is the Pro product. So there are definitely workflows which require a lot more RAM. Not all workflows by any stretch. Like, you know, people got by in 2015 on 16 gigabytes of RAM. So it's not like a deal breaker, but people want to see, like, in those higher spec configurations, you know, Pro level parts and components. And the not excuse, but the reason that they gave for the 2016 not supporting 32 gigabytes of RAM is that the Intel chipset doesn't support low power RAM in 32 gigs. It only goes up to 16. And the revisions on Intel's chips are, we're still waiting for the big, you know, like major revision to this Intel CPU line. So even this year's MacBook Pro does not have any updates to the low power capacity. For instance, the 13-inch MacBook Pro uses low power RAM, and it maxes out at 16.
Mm-hmm.
The way that they've got 32 as an option on the 15-inch is they actually changed the RAM technology they're using, and they no longer use low power RAM. They use normal DDR4 RAM, which allows them to have more at the expense of power.
Yeah,
like they're more draining on the battery life. And I think this is a really, really interesting point, because I don't, when they gave the explanation for the 2016, they were kind of implying that this was how the product was designed, and you could kind of infer from that, like, this form factor of laptop is meant for low power DDR3 RAM only. So fitting the higher power RAM in there is quite a big architectural change, because to compensate for the extra power draw, they've also had to fit more battery inside the actual case itself. So the battery is rated for like another 7 watt-hours now, and their estimates still say the same 10 hours of daily usage. Obviously, who knows what 10 hours means, but the point is, they claim you get the same battery life on these models as you do on the previous models. Yeah. So they've offset the extra battery draw on the RAM with an increase in battery capacity.
Yeah, and so I didn't see a whole lot of attention about that, and also people were upset that the RAM cost more, that it costs so much to have 32 gigabytes of RAM. But I think that's to be expected, is that, you know, if you opt for the higher end, like, it isn't that 32 gigabytes of RAM is even the norm on desktop computers right now. Like, it's still an upgrade. So it's early days for that, and not everyone will need it. So it's fair to charge that.
And rather magically, they made the battery bigger without making the overall weight. The weight's still the same, like 4.03 pounds or something.
Yeah, yeah. And the other big thing this year is that they took the 13-inch from dual core to quad core, and is that an option, or is it all 13 inches now?
I think, yeah, all of the 13 inches are quad core, and then you have options for the speed.
Okay, and then all of the 15 inches are now 6 core.
Yes.
And before it was dual core 13-inch and quad core 15-inch. So now you can get a quad core and a 13-inch if you want to have the speed but not the screen size and the weight associated with that. And then on the MacBook Pro, you can have a 6-core configuration. Although, I guess more on that later, you know, with how it all plays out. But, I mean, so that's kind of nice. Like, 2 years later, you can get more power in a compact machine, which, you know, if your interest is the smaller MacBook, then it's more portable and more powerful. Like, that's a pretty compelling sell, I guess. And then
we mentioned this yet, but they only revved the Touch Bar MacBook Pros.
Yeah.
So the quad core processor, 8th gen Core i5, is available on the Touch Bar MacBook Pro, and they don't sell an alternative configuration with dual core, but they do still sell the non-touch bar 13-inch MacBook Pros. They have two of those default options, and they obviously still use the 7th gen chips and the dual core processor. So yeah, that's an important point. Like, everyone was like doubting Apple's commitment to the touch bar as a thing, and then they come and rev just the touch bar laptops.
Yeah, although there's barely anything new about the touch bar, except I guess the True Tone stuff we'll talk about in a moment. But it feels like that non-touch bar MacBook Pro that was really just there to meet a price point, I think. And then the way they introduced it was, we wanted to have this power and something, I guess, MacBook. They made like a MacBook Air reference to it, but it's not that thin. And it feels like in the fall, like I think it's got to get replaced with something just different, based on what's rumored that thing sticks around, or maybe it just does it and it gets a new chip later on, but it's in a weird place. The other thing is that you can now upgrade your SSD, up to 4 terabytes for what you have in the notes as $3,200. That's to go from 256 gigabyte SSD to 4 terabytes, right? For that upgrade price, so yeah,
yes,
yeah. And before, the max was 2 terabytes, which to me was like really expensive. I think it was like 1,200 maybe. But 2 terabytes, I when I had my 2016 MacBook Pro, I opted for the 1 terabyte SSD, which felt like that was massive, because 1 terabyte's not crazy, but that in an SSD is. And the fact is, SSD prices have not gone down, and they're not using like the ones that you buy on Amazon, you know, the cheap Samsung ones, I guess. Like these are top of the line speed SSDs, and they're not cheap. So to get that much storage, it costs a lot.
Yeah, and there is a slight markup on it, but it's not, you know, miles away from what you would imagine buying. And they're pretty much the, I think this is right, they're the only laptop to offer a 4 terabyte SSD that's actually fast. Like, you can get some really big, hefty laptops that offer like dual slots for the SSDs, and they're just, you know, bulky and slow. But this has the SSD read-write speeds of the iMac Pro, so you can get like 2.5 gigs. Yeah, 2.5 gigs going per second. So, and the average Windows laptop is like 300 meg. So, they give you a lot of bang for the buck there. But yeah, it's another upgrade that pushes the high end of the computer up in price, whilst they haven't reduced the price at the entry level. Because that was one of the other big tenets of complaint back in 2016, was that they were too expensive.
The MacBook Pro entry price was higher at the base than it was the year before, right?
Yeah, because like all the Touch Bar models got $300 more expensive, basically. Mm-hmm. And they're only revving the Touch Bar models, so.
And there's no non-Touch Bar version of the 15-inch, so 15-inch is just a higher price point 2016 and on than it was prior to that.
Yeah, and obviously they're offering, in the successive years, they're improving what's included in those base configurations, but the price has not gone down.
Right.
So if all of the complaints about them getting expensive still hold today as much as they do 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You feel like eventually in generations past, you'd see a price drop eventually. Maybe not within 2 years, but a bit further out. The problem is everyone still like accounts for like the $300 Touch Bar tax, and then says the Touch Bar is a waste of money. So it to a lot of people, it's like paying for something that you don't like and you're not going to use. So it definitely leaves a bad taste in your mouth if you're in that group.
Yeah. And speaking of Touch Bar, Touch Bar was the first time that we saw the T1 chip in a Mac, right? And this version has a T2 chip, which has the same name as the iMac Pro chip, but obviously is responsible for Touch Bar stuff, including Touch ID. And then they afford you now the Hey Siri feature. But what's some more stuff that T2 does for MacBook Pro that you didn't have before?
Yeah, so the T1 drove the Touch Bar and Touch ID, and that was it. And the T2 does those same functionality with driving the Touch Bar, because the T2 is essentially like an A10 processor, and I think it's clocked at something ridiculous. Like, I think I read somewhere it was 2 gigahertz on the co, because the T2 essentially acts as a co-processor for the main computer, right? Yeah. It's the ARM counterpart to the Intel CPU, and the T2 will control. Part of the reason it's clocked so high is that it acts as a storage controller, which manages the SSD, and is one of the big factors that allows them to do the fast SSD read-writes. Mm-hmm. And the previous MacBook Pros didn't use the ARM chip as the storage controller. Like you said, it was just Touch Bar. It was basically just the Touch Bar slave and the Touch ID thing.
The bank for it, right? Yeah.
The bank, yeah. And so basically everything that you saw in the iMac Pro, you can now get in a mobile architecture, including like Secure Boot, and where they can check on launch that the firmware that's installed is signed by Apple and approved, and you can dive into systems configuration and turn that stuff off if you don't want it, but it's on by default, and it provides probably the best security offering of any laptop available.
Practically speaking, is it faster to turn on like File Vault encryption for your whole Mac now with T2? Yes.
Because File Vault on a T2 architecture is what they call essentially zero cost. So there's no performance penalty because it's done at the hardware level rather than being a software thing.
Yeah, whereas before you would want encryption turned on your mobile device, but your mobile device was mobile, so less powerful. And then you could more easily have it on like an iMac without a cost, you know, there associated. But then it's not as important because you're not going to lose your iMac at the airport. So this makes sense, and that's pretty compelling to me.
Yeah, and if you were doing like some tasks that involve a lot of small files would in the past be significantly slowed down by FireVault because it would be decrypting it in software. And then they made it slightly faster when it became SSD because you could read stuff quicker. And now FireVault is close to zero cost. Mm-hmm. And that allows them to report, you know, 2.5 gigs a second read speeds whilst also having full disk encryption turned on.
Right.
So it's doing laps around like the Windows competition on those aspects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely keep FileVault off on my MacBook because my MacBook is not fast on its own. And even if there was no measurable difference to me, I would always just think like I could get a little bit more performance if I had it turned off. So let me do that. And that's what I've done here. Whereas I think with T2, I would be convinced that there's no cost to turning it on. So why not?
Yeah, the only thing that you don't want to do is forget your password.
Right. I was thinking that as I was speaking was the only cost is if you forget your encryption password, then you're done with that computer.
Well, you can flash it and restart from factory settings, obviously. Mm-hmm. So you presumably keep backups at home.
Yeah.
And also I think if you this is more applies to the iMac Pro, but because of the way that it works, like the T2 chip is paired to the SSD controllers, so you couldn't like swap out the SSD and have it work because like the security signing would just fail on both ends. In the same way that if you try and replace an iPhone screen, you also have to get a new home button on the older style iPhones and on the iPhone 10. And in the future, it will be the same with the Face ID sensor stuff. Like the logic board pairs with the authentication biometrics, so you can't. And it's all in the name of security, right? Like hardening it down, making it harder for other people to come in and swap out components and trying to trick the system.
Yeah, it's just that eventually this level of security becomes the norm because it can spread across devices. But for now, it's iMac Pro and then now MacBook Pro that can afford to do it by nature being powerful.
And you can think like of the government and high enterprise situations where the idea of having like proper full disk encryption without penalty is a very big attraction.
Yeah.
Even if today the high-end MacBook Pros are not, you know, what those businesses want to buy, it's not going to be too long, I don't think, until that T2 architecture proliferates down the line.
Sure. Yeah. And then in the short term, it does at least power the always listening, or as long as you're booted, listening for the command to control Siri, which is the first for Mac. So far, you've had an ugly menu bar icon that people turn off, and then a dock icon for Siri or a keyboard shortcut. But all of those
touch bar icon, don't forget that.
Oh, touch bar icon too. Sure, all of those involve some type of, you know, hand manipulation to activate it. Which to me, like just thinking about this, Siri and the Mac. Forget that it can't do as quite as much as Siri everywhere else. But it's learning. Like, it learned how to do HomeKit this year, so that's nice. Siri the Mac could be the best version because it's kind of like the most multitasking Siri there is, because every other Siri is full screen, whereas Siri on the Mac is a pop over window that does not interrupt what you're doing. Like, you can type in a document on the left of your screen and activate Siri on the right of your screen, except before now, that involved using your mouse or your keyboard or, you know, something to turn it on. You could,
yeah, like if you're in the middle of typing a document, you have to then stop your fingers and do something else, like activate the
Siri. Yeah, it's like you're physically interrupting yourself, so you really can't keep multitasking that way. Well, now with this new MacBook Pro, thanks to the T2 chip, it always listens for that magic phrase, hey, and then Siri, and you can do those things. You can type in a Word document and then talk to Siri on the side without it interrupting what you're doing, which to me is like – pretty compelling. Like, you know, before you need a second device to do that. That's pretty cool. The big question mark there is, because the iMac Pro also has the T2 chip, at least in the name it's the same, and a lot of the tasks are the same, will it come to the iMac Pro? We've had one tip so far today that says in macOS Mojave Beta 4, they can see the setup screen for turning it on and training your voice with it, but the Siri's busted on the beta, which is the experience for me on my MacBook because the Siri doesn't talk. So maybe it's coming in Mojave, but we've not been able to test it. I know Jeff Benjamin has an iMac Pro, and I'd ask if he could try it out by booting from an external drive into Mojave, but because of the nature of the T2 chip, it didn't happen. He wasn't able to do that. So, it's not worth, doing the beta version on his production machine. So, but maybe iMac Pro is getting, that feature as well. But for now,
I would hold some reservations. I think if it was coming to the iMac Pro, they would have announced it alongside the MacBook Pro announcement.
Yeah. There is precedent for having the same chip name and there being, under the hood changes that make it not possible on older versions of that chip, and then on newer versions it is possible. Goes back to the iPad, right?
Yeah. So the all of Apple's chips are just marketing names. Like what does Bionic mean? It's just a name. What does Fusion mean? It's just a name. And because they're like the brand associations, I think people get that more. But like the numbers are just names as well. Like S1, S2, the S1P, like all of these numbers and symbols are just ways of Apple to make it clearer to market to their customers. They have some relation to the underlying architecture changes, but it's not one-to-one by any means. Like they're not the model numbers you use if you're doing a technical discussion. And I would be shocked if the T2 chip in the laptop is identical to the T2 chip in the iMac.
Mm-hmm.
Or even if it is the same, parts of the computer might not be hooked up to it.
Yeah.
For instance, the microphones, right? So at some point, the microphone signal has to get into the T2 chip so it can co-process the audio all the time. I would be surprised if the iMac Pro has the microphone funneling through that thing for the cases that it needs to be able to work constantly. And I think if it was possible, they would have said already, because it's like an obvious question that T2, hey Siri, and then here's this other computer that has T2 but no Siri. So it's like, I would not hold up your hopes.
Yeah, I actually had a background call with Apple about these MacBook Pros earlier this week, and it came up as a question, but there was no definitive answer, which made me, like, the way it was answered was that who knows. Could be planned, could be, but it wasn't a topic of discussion for that day, at least.
When this was announced, I saw some like criticism on Twitter, like, why did they even bother? And
what do you mean? With what?
Why they bother adding the hot word detection?
Okay, yeah.
And it's like, sure, Siri on the Mac is not great at the moment, but adding this feature is perfectly logical. And if you want a Siri that works the same across all platforms, then adding, a hot word mode to your laptops is perfectly natural because it's a mobile device. It should work like the iOS devices should to an average consumer. And I do think you have to have some forward-looking perspective where Siri on the Mac today isn't great, but what if, 10.15 Siri takes everything on that you can do on iOS and puts it in there, adds all the extensions, adds some version of shortcuts, integrate with Automator, or, if they port the workflow shortcuts to the Mac. There's a lot of, expansion they could do there, And I think those 2018 MacBook Pro customers will be very happy that the feature was added last year for them when they, if they do do that
in yeah.
OS release. Yeah.
To me, the big feature this year is that you can talk to Siri on the Mac to control HomeKit. And so by being able to do that, I would find myself wanting to use Siri more on the Mac. And then the next point of friction is, you know, physically clicking the button when other devices, I can just say the phrase to, like HomePod or the watch or the phone or the iPad. And so by making it parity with the other devices, I'm more likely to, recall the Mac as an option that can do that and use that. And then, like you said, I mean, I think for the people that ask that question, shortcuts would be the big thing. And you can see where in a year or two or three that, you know, Automator is either, you know, retired or changes in a way that we see, you know, the same way that we're seeing iOS apps come to the Mac. We see like literally the Shortcuts app come to the Mac in some way. And then Siri learn how to talk to Shortcuts on the Mac just like it can on other devices. And then that would be, I think, really compelling, you know, especially because it is in this multitasking environment where Siri can stay open over here and you keep talking to it with a UI popped up while you're working on the other side of your screen. I think that's pretty compelling. And there's no reason that it shouldn't be the best or most powerful version of Siri because it is on, you know, arguably the most powerful machines in that case. So, and there are things you can do with Siri now that I think like being able to use your voice to control it is useful, like controlling iTunes music, for example. I think you can do podcasts on the Mac. I'm not sure though, just because maybe you can't. But and then there's like clever things that Siri can do, like find. I think you can find files with Siri on the Mac.
Like file search. You can ask about like various computer specs. Like,
yeah, I know you can do specs.
In that first release of Siri on the Mac, they added some like very specific Mac things.
Yeah, you just can't set a timer yet on the Mac. So wait until Clock gets Marzipan over, and then that'll happen. So
every time we bring this up, it's just like, if I pull my one hair out every time this was a problem, like, I'd just be bald by the end of the year. Like, come on, John Giandri, you can kick him into shape.
Yeah, yeah. So, beyond being able to activate Siri with your voice now, I don't have one of these machines yet, and I've not I've not begged people to tell me like how things work yet, but I am curious, like what are the different states that Siri responds in? Like I imagine if your Mac is closed and locked, it won't work. And I imagine that if it's open, but like display is off and it's locked, like you need to enter a password, it wouldn't work. But that as long as like your Mac is open and display is on and it's unlocked, like maybe even if its display is off but it's unlocked, then Siri responds. So that's something I need to try out and see how it all works. But there was one question a few years ago about why Siri in the Mac doesn't respond to that phrase, and I think Phil Schiller was quoted as saying that you would need to have, you know, for one, the coprocessor always listening for the phrase, and then it would need to respond. I think it was something about the state of the Mac would need to make sense. Like you need to trust that it can respond to you. And they at least got one with the processor, but I'm not sure that it will always make sense on the Mac in the way that he had said. Although
he was specifically saying it should work while your Mac's asleep.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that they've done that, but at least in the MacBook Pro side, if people use that in front of them, you know, like if you're not using it, it's probably closed, I would guess. Whereas like the iMac, I can see it being like in standby across the room, and then you might expect it to listen to you, and it not. So, we'll see how that works out. Next thing is True Tone, and what do you think? You think True Tone is what Quo mentioned is a powerful display performance improvement to the iMacs? Because what True Tone is Apple uses a sensor to read the ambient lighting in the room, and adjust the color temperature of the display to try and match that. So if you're in like bright white lighting, it looks normal. And if you're in a darker room, it turns like the temperatures are warmer. Looks more like what Night Shift turned on would look like. So it tries to look natural in the room and not like a computer screen.
Yeah, like automatic screen brightness is just how bright is the ambient light in the room. And then True Tone works by getting like a sense of the color temperature of the room.
Yeah, and that works on the MacBook Pro display and the Touch Bar. And if you're connected to a Thunderbolt display from Apple that's been discontinued, or an LG Ultrafine 5K or 4K display, as long as obviously your Mac is open because the sensor is on the screen, and if you're in clamshell mode using your MacBook as like a tower replacement, then you're not going to have the feature working then. And again, I ask if like this works with other displays too, and I don't think there was a clear like understanding there. So I'm curious if people have these to try it out and see.
Well, I think there's a pretty clear difference between the ones you mentioned and every other screen, is that the Thunderbolt and the Ultrafine screens, from within macOS, you can change the brightness. You can change the brightness level of the external display. Like, I don't have one of those screens, and I have to, you know, use my fingers and click on the hardware buttons on the screen and mess around in the silly menus. One of the nice things about the Ultrafine panels is, however they talk over the Thunderbolt connection, it reports its brightness status to the system, and you, in the software, you can drag your mouse cursor over a slider and change the screen's brightness.
Night Shift on your display?
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, maybe you can then.
Yeah, Night Shift. Because Night Shift, would they change the... Oh, I see what you mean. Like, it's
Yeah. The response that I got was that they didn't rule it out as a possibility, which I think if it works, it would work today. But that things like TVs might have their own settings anyway for the room. Like, you might have like a theater mode for your TV, and then if you change the color temperature beyond what you have your TV set to, then it might not look right at all. But that display, computer displays are different. So like a Dell monitor could work, maybe, and you know, but there wasn't like a concrete response there. It was just that TVs we wouldn't want to do that with, but then computer displays makes more sense too.
I mean, you could plug your laptop into the TV with Night Shift on, and it would mess up the color temperatures anyway.
Yeah.
The True Tone was a nice surprise. Whether it mean it's hard, because what Quo said was coming from the iMac was a display performance upgrade.
Yeah,
and it would qualify as that description, but to me, it doesn't feel like that is what he meant.
He's still hopeful that there could be higher refresh rate or something different than True Tone.
Yeah.
Plus the fact that he didn't say it for MacBook and he said it for iMac, you know, and Quo doesn't get these that wrong. Maybe this one he did, but, you know.
And True Tone itself makes more sense with a mobile device than a device that doesn't move on your desk.
Well, for that, I totally disagree, because my lighting changes in my office throughout the day, like, because it's on my iPad. If I use my iPad only in the office, it depends on, are the windows open, is the light on, the ceiling light, or is it
okay? Oh, yeah, I'll give you that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, I yeah. Retract my
okay, thank you
opposition for that.
This week, 95 Mac Happy Hour is sponsored by Udemy. Udemy offers over 60,000 online courses on a variety of fresh topics, so you can learn anything on your schedule. Udemy is the largest and most accessible online learning marketplace, with the most courses, teachers, and opportunities for students everywhere around the globe. Udemy offers courses on a range of topics, including brand new lectures and classes on iOS 12 and Xcode 10, learning to develop apps with Swift 5, and even courses on how to shoot better photos from your iPhone, with updates specifically for iOS 12 before it's even public. And even though Udemy has a wealth of knowledge about technology topics, Udemy has teachers with expertise in a wide range of areas. For example, I've been brushing up on a nutrition masterclass to learn more about meal planning and healthy eating, which includes over 3.5 hours of video, and I've got courses on music production and photography queued up after that. The best part about Udemy is how it fully embraces technology. You can view courses on your Mac, iPhone, or iPad. View course content by section and complete quizzes as you learn, access a Q&A section between other students and instructors, and even bookmark specific sections in the videos just by pressing the B key. So check out Udemy and learn how to improve your skills today. Go to ude.my/happyhour right now and get 90% off when you sign up for classes. You'll not find better prices, so sign up for classes now using our link, ude.my/happyhour, and get access to life-changing classes for 90% off. And make sure to download Udemy's app for your iPhone so you can stream your studies wherever you go. That's ude.my/happyhour, ude.my/happyhour. Thanks to Udemy for sponsoring the show.
The high frame rate thing would be fantastic.
Yeah.
It's still, there isn't signs in like the supply chain that that's anywhere close. I will be happily impressed though if that is what that turns out to be.
You have to buy it if they do it.
Oh, don't go down that rabbit hole.
And it would only be the Mac Pro, so you'd be out $5,000 at least. So,
It said consumer iMac, remember?
Yeah. They didn't say Pro, but
they didn't
yeah.
specify. They just said iMac.
Yeah. Such your tone. I'm curious what the effect is on the touch bar itself, because I can picture it on the display, and I've mentioned on lots of episodes before that I turn it off on everything I have. Like on my iPhone 10, I prefer it turned off on. It just looks so much better to me having it turned off. Like the colors look the way it's supposed to, because otherwise when I'm inside, it's always on and I don't like the way it looks. And then on the iPad, the same situation. And I've seen a lot of people that are buying these new MacBook Pros for like pro uses say, I wouldn't want it on because it would change my reference material, like of the video or the photos that I'm editing, or you know, that kind of thing. But it is neat. Like if you're mainly writing, then you're looking at like a white document, and it can be blinding, and having it warm up to your eyes without it having to be at nighttime can be like literally comforting to your eyes.
About the adaptivity, if you're doing like, you know, a photo editing thing on iOS, apps can tell the system what kind of true tone mode they should be in. So you can have like a reading mode, you can have a photo mode, you can have a like a one-to-one, basically don't use true tone mode.
Mm-hmm.
So the app can say inside of this you know, photo editing app, the user wants to see accurate color reproduction, they don't want the true tone effect to happen,
right?
I believe there is no such API for that on macOS at the moment. And it's more complicated on macOS because you can have multiple windows anywhere. And so an app by app, true tone on and off, you know, wouldn't really work. It'd have to be like a global switch.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's just like, oh, they didn't do it. It was also, it's a lot harder to even imagine how they would implement something like that, because what I assume you had three windows side by side and all three of them had different true tone preferences. I guess it would just pick one and do what it can. Like yeah. On the iPad, they choose the foreground app. So if you've got a split view, it prioritizes what the big one does.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Like, that's the primary app.
Yeah.
On the Mac, you don't really have that distinction as much. So you'd need some policy of picking out, oh, if all these four apps want different true tone modes, which one do I go for? And they could add that as a, you know, in like a 10.14.1. That's the kind of small scale API minor improvement that you could see through the cycle. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't like completely rule it out. It does help mitigate the, oh, I'm a pro photo editor,
but I'm never going
to
use it.
I just like browsing the web on my laptop. I want to be able to use True Tone, but it's a pain because I can't use it when I'm doing my work. So there's definitely advantage to doing it, but it requires more thought than what they do on iOS at the moment.
Yeah. And in terms of having it on the Mac, though, I am excited about that because it was jarring today to be able to have it on iPad, iPhone, and then not the Mac. The biggest, you know, arguably, possibly the biggest display that you have around. And now you can have, like, if you want to use it, now you can have it on all of these screens and they'll all look the same. It won't look like one is not, you know, natural the way that the other ones look. So that's nice. And it applies to the touch bar. So I'm curious what that effect looks like. The touch bar is funny because it's Retina, right? And it's OLED. But it's to me, it's not never looked like super sharp, like as sharp as the display itself.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure if it's Pentile or not, but it definitely seems it is technically pixel density wise double and the same as the main display, but it definitely always seems blurrier when you're looking at it.
Yeah, and it doesn't.
I think there's like slight color hue shift on the edges of the icons.
Mm-hmm.
Which make it see, which kind of blur the black and the whites together. Like if you look really close, you can kind of see it's not a sharp edge, which doesn't happen on like the iPhone 10 display. The iPhone 10 display has different problems. I wish I could remember this. I believe that the Touch Bar OLED is from LG, is not from Samsung, which would explain why it doesn't have like terrible blue shifting, which would mean it's not AMOLED. It's not like a Pentile layout, but then. That would mean it's not as good in other areas, right? Which could contribute to why it always seems like slightly a little bit blurry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'll be curious to look at the effect that True Tone has when it's you know cranked up by necessity on the Touch Bar too. And then if you have one of those displays, the LG or the Apple discontinued display, then you get a new feature for free as long as your Mac is open, obviously, because the sensor needs to read the room. And then maybe other displays too that just aren't listed. You know, I guess we'll hear back and we'll see.
Maybe they add more in the future that have the same you know special interaction with the operating system, for instance.
So True Tone, yay. And then, you know, the thing everyone cares about is the keyboard. And we kind of, you know, made this discussion last week is that if they do a new Mac, does the keyboard automatically fall into the repair program? And the answer is no so far, because it is different than the previous keyboard. It's still Butterfly, but it's what they're calling the third generation Butterfly keyboard. And what they mean by third generation is it's quieter. And they mentioned this on their call with me that some customers were not pleased with the acoustics of the previous keyboard, and that this one is a little quieter. So I don't know. Have you listened to some of the capture comparisons that people have done? Of
the online video comparisons, I find it hard to spit the hairs between them.
I don't think I could do a blind test and tell you which is which.
Yeah. It could be one of those things where the dulling of the sound like has like a psychological impact that affects you more in person and it sounds quieter.
Yeah.
But on the videos, it doesn't come across.
Yeah. It's just audio is tough on devices anyway. You know,
Laurel. What's funny about the quieter marketing is that last year in the 2017 revision, they added like little rubber gaskets in certain places, and that made it quieter as well. But that last year, it wasn't a marketing point; they just did it silently. And this year, it's like we've got a new keyboard design that's quieter.
Yeah, it was part of the press release, part of the MacBook Pro marketing page, and then, like I said, part of my briefing on this. And That's okay, cool. And then I fix it as their teardown, and they find that there is what they call a thin silicone barrier under each key, which, like, if you ask Apple, I'm sure they're going to say that's so it's quieter, that dampens the sound. But it's totally plausible to expect that could also protect the keyboard from having, you know, dust and debris getting caught under it and in between keys and contributing to that sticky key problem that the people have.
And we don't know.
We don't know. Like maybe.
We don't know.
Maybe it helps.
Because the silicone like cocoon has to have holes in it because the top of the keys go through and connect to the switches.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like a perfect seal. So at most it's going to reduce the likelihood of dust getting in there.
Yeah. There's at least less space
to
now.
The scales to make them, you know, quote-unquote reliable again. Like, yes, it only affects if a small percentage of people, according to Apple. That small percentage is basically everyone on my Twitter feed, including me, and including you, right? You have your key stick constantly.
Yeah, all the time on three different machines that I've had since 2016, and they got a lot of feedback on our episode about the repair program and people saying that they are in my camp where you have the problem, but you've never told Apple because you don't expect it to be repaired, and there's a repair program. You need to be able to send your Mac away for a little while, and I've not been able to do that yet. And I've heard from a few people that they also don't have this the affordance to be able to not have their Mac, you know, for several days or even.
Yeah, I'm in the same camp. Mm-hmm. While I wrote the MacBook Pro story 2018 on the site, and whilst I was writing it, my B key broke so that when you tapped it, it would type B.
It was funny. I saw the person on Twitter who replied to you. And basically said that you're being, you know, theatrical and trying to make a funny and that it's not a real problem. And then you're able to supply video of tap the C, the V, the B, the N each one time. And you see on your screen, the B key double up on the screen. So,
and then the person was like, I apologize. Yeah, I know. It was a surprisingly positive Twitter conversation.
Yes.
I thought it was going to go down one weird rabbit hole, but fair play to the guy. He admitted he was wrong. In the past, on my keyboard, I have had stuck keys. I've had repeating keys. But I tend to just bash the key for a while and it goes away.
Yeah.
This B problem has persisted through today at the time of recording. So that's, you know, almost a week later now. And my B key is still repeating itself twice.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm on the edge of going to call the repair company, call Apple and try and get AppleCare on it. But at the same time, this is my only computer. So I have, you know, pragmatic issues with actually doing that.
Which is a shame because you kept your old MacBook Pro for so long until recently that you, it's too bad. I think it's quite possible that the silicone layer is there to reduce this possibility, but that it's not tested enough for Apple to know. And that's part of why, like, there are so many reasons why they might not be able to say we fixed the keyboard problem, because they might not know they have for sure. And we've seen that before in software updates where they think that something fixes the problem. Wasn't that how the battery gate issue happened, you know, started because they didn't properly announce the throttling that they were doing because they weren't sure if it was going to work or not to prevent accidental restarts. Well,
yeah, and the recent one was iMessages out of order. They had that update. They're like, we fixed the messages appearing out of order, and then everyone still had it for another two updates.
Yeah, so you don't want to think you fixed it and say you did, but then you didn't. And I imagine that whenever Apple released these keyboards the first time, like on the MacBook 12-inch in 2015, that they didn't know quite the scale that it would be, you know, regardless of what they're saying publicly, that they didn't anticipate this would be the case, or they wouldn't have applied it to the MacBook Pro. I don't think. I think it would be done to do this all intentionally and planned. So maybe they're not so sure yet if this does, and then maybe in the future they can say that is the one. We do believe that when you have your MacBook repaired under the repair program, that you don't get this keyboard. So that's part of it. But then there's all these risks of can you admit that this fixes the problem if you're being sued over the problem and expect that to go well? So it's really complicated, and we don't even know if it fixes, you know, the problem of durability. Time will tell, I guess.
You can't, morally you probably should, but let's assume they think they have fixed it. If they came out and said, we fixed the keyboard, they'd have me, they'd have you, they'd have all the previous buyers of the MacBook Pro from 2016 and 2017 just complaining at them. The lawsuits would get even bigger, please replace my keyboard with the new one. Because I'm pretty sure that the size of the keyboard hasn't changed, so it's theoretically possible they could put the third generation keys style in the older models,
mm-hmm.
and they just foot the bill for it. So on the legal liability front, I'm not surprised in the slightest that they don't want to say we fix something, because as soon as you say you fix something, they're confirming that there was a problem in the first place.
Yeah.
We've also seen that the repairs, if you want to do the repair program, your MacBook 2016, 2017 will get replaced with the second generation, with the, not the second generation, the 2017 version of the butterfly keys, so you won't get the silicone added underneath yours. So if you're thinking, oh, great, now I've got an even more secure laptop, you won't. I'll be interested to see what happens in 2-3 years when they start running out of stock of the second generation mechanism. Then maybe they'll go, oh, we'll just give everyone third generations. But for now, they're running through the second generation keys. You only get the quote-unquote quieter ones on the 2018 models.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess to be seen how this goes, even in terms of is this new keyboard more reliable or not, you know. So we'll see. It is tricky. It's like, would you recommend this computer to family based on the possibility that the keyboard can have a problem that Apple, you know, acknowledged with the previous version of this keyboard? And when asked, I think The Verge was the first that I saw that had asked, was the keyboard designed to be more durable? And they said, no, it was designed to be quieter, and that, you know, few people have that problem on the other one. It's like that wasn't encouraging. But then whenever iFixit finds this silicone layer, that is more encouraging. It's like, they couldn't talk about it. We're using quieter as a euphemism for more durable. But
I would not take the word of a third-party repair company to heart when considering a, you know, multi-thousand-dollar purchase of a computer.
Yeah,
it's just stupid to do that. Like, if I tell you that the iMac Pro is the best computer in the world, you're not just going to go out and buy it because iFixit, this like teardown company, they haven't even released their full report on the keyboard yet. I mean, they're apparently doing tests on, you know, to try and work out if it's actually more durable or not, but we don't know yet. It's just, there's a silicone bit there. It must fix the problem, even though that silicone does have holes in it, so there's still plenty of outlets for the dust to actually get through those layers.
Yeah. And then, as if the keyboard wasn't enough, there's already a new controversy about these MacBook Pros, which is an issue with throttling on the higher-end models, so specifically for the i9 model. And isn't this the first time that we have an i9 and a MacBook Pro?
Yeah. The i9 designation is similar to Apple's mocking of the A12 Bionic chip. It's kind of the same there. Like, there's not that much difference between the i7 and the i9 that are in the laptops, really.
In the 12-inch MacBook, you can get a model with a Core M or a faster Core M or an i3. And I think the difference in Core M and i3 is just the speed. And that Intel called the i3 that, even though it's like not fast. So that it's just speed, marketing for the different speed variances. But it is a 6-core, it has a clock speed of a certain amount. And the idea is you get that clock speed as a base, and then it can like turbo boost when needed to faster speeds as well. And what testing has shown I think the YouTuber's name is Dave Lee. Is that right? He was editing video in Adobe Premiere, and under that condition, which is not extraordinary, heat made the computer much slower. Like, the computer acknowledged heat and decided to slow down the machine by a lot, like slower than the base clock speed.
Yeah, but like sometimes it was even going down to like 800 megahertz.
Yeah.
And he did a benchmark of exporting a Premiere video, and the 2017 was faster than the highest-end MacBook 2018 configuration.
Remove two cores, and then you had a faster machine. Not because the base was faster, but because it just wasn't slowing down like the higher core model was. Yeah,
yeah, and a bit of pretext here. We're still on like the TokTok iteration of the Intel CPUs, so there's not a big architecture advancement. And so core over core, there's like a 5% increase per core in terms of performance over the last couple of years. The reason that they're able to market these machines as so much faster is because they've added two cores to both the 13-inch and the 15-inch model. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you add more cores, you're again, it doesn't scale linearly, but you're like multiplying your overall performance.
Yeah, I think
5% on each core plus two more cores.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, on the MacBook Pro, so they have percentages for this, but I think on the MacBook Pro, so it's like they say like up to 50% faster. And it's like, yeah, you have 50% of the computer again. Like, makes sense. So
yeah, and again, it doesn't scale perfectly depending on what task you're doing, because many tasks are single threaded, etc. The big problem is if the laptop's design can't support the thermal, because the trade-off with these especially the i9 is that it gets very hot.
Yeah.
And the design of the laptop didn't change. They didn't make it any thicker, or there's no new fan design or anything like that. And so it seems like, at least on these early tests, that in some situations, including like Premiere video export, which is a key market for, you know, pro Mac creators, you're actually going to be pulling back the speed of the computer so that you'd be better off if you just turned the two cores off and used it as a Qualcomm machine. Mm-hmm. And it's not clear yet whether this is like an inherent hardware flaw, design choice, whatever you want to call it, if there's software mitigations Apple could do, because Jeff Benjamin was doing some tests on his i9 MacBook Pro, and it was like throttling down to like a gigahertz clock speed when the temperature of the processor was only about 80 degrees. That's Celsius. But that isn't actually that hot. Like, you'd normally expect that it wouldn't be like throttling to such severe degrees until you hit, you know, you're nearing on the triple digit mark. So it's not clear to me yet whether there's actually like a software problem at play here that hopefully will, you know, sort out some of these rough edges. But if it is like just unavoidable, then that's pretty bad. The MacBook Pros have always throttled, but never to this extent. And It's kind of a bad sign when like the most expensive computer can't be at least as fast as the previous years.
Yeah.
On certain things, just because the thermals overpower it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are always trade-offs. Like, if you have a 6-core computer and you're doing a highly parallelized task, or you're doing a task in short bursts before the CPU can get too hot. Like, the thing with video export is that it takes a long time. Like, you're doing like a 5-minute continuous thing. For Xcode, for instance, I doubt that you'll be throttling the chips, because it's like build and it takes like 30 seconds most of the time, and you do build and it's like 30 seconds every few minutes. So it's not like universal, this one's slower, but it's not like a glowing recommendation either, because they're like the gotchas, and this is still developing because not many people have them yet, so we haven't got like full testing on this stuff. But it's not a great sign at the current time of recording.
Yeah, if you look on the MacBook Pro product page and you go to Nvidia, for example, Final Cut Pro 10, for a lot of the examples, they show how much faster it is to do an effect on something, or export a project, that kind of thing. For Final Cut Pro, like, for example, compressor says 75% faster for one of their examples and 55% faster on another example. For Final Cut Pro, they don't use a speed difference. And so the idea is video. They show how many simultaneous 4K streams are supported. And they show 9 with the 6-core. And then they don't show the number for the quad core, but it's fewer. The bar is shorter. So I wonder.
It's because the 13-inch can't do that many simultaneous streams.
Right. So
it simply can't do them, so there's nothing, it's the same as last year. That's why it only shows the 15-inch benchmark.
Right, but what I mean is they're not showing that this is faster at video export, and I wonder if that's a choice they made here, is that, you know, like you said, you can do something in Xcode quickly and is powerful, fast, and done, but for video export, it takes a while anyway, and it's, can you keep that speed up for so long? Maybe not by design. And so for that reason, they use this spec of how many streams you can have, not how fast is the export.
And in the Dave Lee video, he puts the MacBook Pro in a freezer and it speeds it up. That's funny, but that phenomenon you can do with any of the MacBook Pros. Like, they're all heat constrained. Apple loves the thinness. They don't put the fans on to full. You can always find cases of every previous MacBook Pro being throttled doing some tasks, and making it cooler will make it run faster.
I should get a fan for my
MacBook. I don't recommend
putting
it into a freezer long term, because you cause like condensation and other problems. The particular issue with this one is that it seems to have a higher tendency to throttle, even to the point where it turns out to be slower than the previous year.
Yeah.
And I expect there's some software tweaks Apple can do, but it'll also be like a bit of column A, a bit of column B. Like, this is just what happens when you take the same case design, you put in a much, you know, more heat creating chip in the i9 to the same body, like without redesigning stuff.
Yeah,
you're going to hit like thermal limits.
Yeah. So it feels like, based on what Jeff was finding, like you said, the temperature was lower than what you would expect for throttling to happen, that it could be that they could adjust that and decrease the threshold for when throttling kicks in, and then you don't have that problem as frequently. It's nothing that I think I would even experience myself. So, but again, if you pay that money, you don't want that to happen behind the scenes either. So, hopefully there's some response to that. And then, you know, we mentioned a couple of things last week. One was, you know, is there room for like a more pro level MacBook Pro? And I think like spec wise, we got a lot of that today or this week with this new update in terms of now there's 6 core, now there's 32 gigabytes of RAM, there's 4 terabytes of SSD, all these changes, you know, the T2 chip. But there could be like one that is a MacBook Pro that is thicker, that doesn't, you know, if it turns out this throttling thing is something that lasts and that can't be resolved in software really, then that would be like the definitive, yes, there's room for a different design that can accommodate more power.
Yeah, and the other big like thing that people were upset about with this revision was that the graphics cards didn't get a lot better and they're still using like mobile chips that aren't, they're only like 10% faster when they could, there are other Windows laptops that are, yes, a lot thicker, but they include like, you know, GTX 1050 cards, like much bigger, beefier cards. So if you're doing like heavy graphics processing, they're probably a better option. Again, it's trade-offs with, you know, lightness and weight and all that stuff. It's all a big bag of, you know, choices. But obviously the point of a pro machine a lot of the time is to do that stuff more than favoring, you know, thin and light design. So it's the constant Apple tension.
And on that note, they're relying on the eGPU support that they've added to macOS as of, I guess, earlier last year. And now they have their own that they endorse, the Blackmagic Design eGPU. And I think, is it the same GPU as an iMac 27-inch?
Approximately. Like, yeah. There's a penalty you pay for going over the cable.
Sure.
So you're not going to, like, match it one for one, but
yeah,
you get within the right ballpark.
Yeah, and so that makes your MacBook Pro more like an iMac in the GPU space, and you can connect your MacBook Pro to it and to an LG 5K display to have it power the MacBook Pro over the Thunderbolt cable. You get an HDMI port in the back. I think you get some USB-A in the back too. So it's like, I mean, it's not a portable thing really. It's for your desk. But if you want the best of both worlds without having an iMac, then you pay a lot of money for the portability and, you know, the several $100 for this eGPU. But then you can kind of have that in one machine. Jeff Benjamin did a video review of this eGPU, which is interesting because he's been doing eGPU reviews since a little bit before the system really supported, because with High Sierra, it was an advertised feature, but it wasn't going to come until later in a future update to it. And he was along for the ride the whole way. And so I think his take on this was that it's nice, but it's not the best eGPU you can buy, even though it's like the Apple endorsed one now. And also with this enclosure, like, this is the GPU you get, right? And then that there are other eGPU cases that let you change out the GPU, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Like you get like a caddy that you put a graphics card into and you can use it, whereas this one's fixed in place.
Yeah, you will forever have this generation of GPU, just like all the other, you know, things inside of the MacBook Pro itself. So some things to consider there. But the, you know, for things like, I guess, like VR, you know, anything graphical, this is what they're endorsing rather than changing the GPU inside of the MacBook Pro itself to something way different, which is just another point to say there probably is room for a higher end, even more expensive MacBook Pro for pros that makes different choices. And then, you know, obviously, I think one of the things that's appealing there is that, you know, you could change the port situation. Like, they're still doing 4 USB-C ports, a Thunderbolt 3 ports, which I can live with. I would like the SD card slot for convenience, but other people want other ports. And so, you know, maybe that theoretical machine could make those trade-offs, just like the iMac Pro does and the iMac does for that matter. But all in all, I mean, if the keyboard situation like wasn't part of the story and the throttling didn't pop up, then I think this would be a pretty big year over year increase, especially 2 years over increase.
Yeah, like it's a lot better than the 2017 update.
Yeah, which was a
significant architecture change with the T2 underneath, and you know, file vault and secure boot, plus the really fast SSDs. You're getting a nice CPU increase. Like, even if you just get the base model, you don't upgrade to the i9, you're still going to be doing significantly better performance on most tasks, caveats aside. Like, and you get the 32 gigabytes of RAM, and that shows Apple has responded to market forces, I think. Like, if there wasn't such a big backlash in 2016, I wouldn't be surprised if they'd have carried on down the low-power RAM train for the entire generation until the Intel chipsets caught up. So I think it shows that Apple's listening in some ways. I'm not surprised the case didn't change at all. Like, this is, like, probably the best you're going to get without the case changing.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's literally less than 2 years after the first version, and now we're on the third generation of this style. And that's pretty good, considering before, I mean, the mood was, when is Apple going to update these machines, you know, in a big way? And I think three, one per year, you know, even though the timing is different parts of the fall, different parts of the summer, one per year is a pretty good record so far. Like, unless I got to make a big change, this is not ignoring the MacBook Pro. That's for sure. And, you know,
yeah, I'd agree with that.
Mm-hmm. But if you don't like this MacBook Pro, it's just a better version of the one that you don't like, so that's problematic. You know, if you have issues with the 2016 one for other reasons than the specs themselves, but I'm compelled. I've not bought one. I've not ordered one yet, simply because I would want a really nice one and probably not a base model one, and that's not an impulse purchase. You know, it's one to sleep on. I'm looking at the page every day, so yeah, we'll see. Let's knock out a few more topics before we wrap up for the week. One thing that is especially of interest to me that you discovered today is that doorbell cameras are no longer a category on Apple's HomeKit page. And the situation there has been, since 2016, there have been promises from companies, especially August, that existing doorbell video camera hardware would be upgraded through software to support HomeKit, even as far as the CEO saying, we knew about HomeKit and we supplied the right chip for this to happen. In this fall, 2016, we will release HomeKit support for our video doorbell camera. And they never did. And for years, we've gone back and forth and said, any update? No working with Apple. And finally today, Apple took the announced section off of their website, and it's no longer a category for HomeKit, it appears.
Yeah, I guess it just signals that there's more delays, and the chances of seeing the August doorbell cam this year is very, very slim at this point. We asked Apple for comment. They haven't provided a comment. I think it's just the classic case of the HomeKit certification process takes a long time, and there's a big backlog, and it's kind of like accessory manufacturers are begging Apple to tell them what to change, and then Apple's kind of slow to respond and a bit inscrutable about it. And it just ends up in like this big long queue of stuff taking time. And even though they've got some initiatives more recently about ways to make this approval process faster and bringing HomeKit devices to market quicker, they're still going to have those products on those strategies, essentially, are only being built, you know, from now. And they've still got a massive backlog of all the old style stuff to get through. So
yeah.
I think it's partly on them. Doorbell manufacturers are partly on Apple, but the doorbell manufacturers are too nice to, you know, put the ball in Apple's court, really, because they're afraid of getting cut off.
Yeah, and wasn't it Ring that was bought by Amazon? And they said, you know, everyone's you just assume that Amazon isn't going to support HomeKit. And they said, no, we still are. It's coming very, very soon. Trust us, very soon. And we've not
seen...
that
was February, and it's now July. So.
Yeah, so we've not seen that yet. And August made a new version of their doorbell camera called Pro that doesn't support HomeKit yet. I've asked August about it. They had a nice announcement today. They said, hey, we hit 1 million customers. It's like, okay, what about a HomeKit for the doorbell? I'll check on that for you. I haven't heard back yet. in the past, they've gone as far as to say, please don't mention it. So, like, it's gone so long.
Well, that, Apple listened to him.
Yeah, it's gone so far that that my contact there has changed over the years because they've moved on to different jobs. So, yeah, it's not optimistic. Like, what I have right now for my doorbell camera is a Logicircle 2 camera mounted to the window of my door. I'm lucky enough to have, like, a window there to work with, but then the trade-off there is that you don't have the intercom functionality. You know, you can see what's there, you can receive a motion alert to see, like, is there motion, okay, turn on the camera, you can see it, but you can't talk to the other person on the other side, which is not convenient. And my theory on all of this is that the big roadblock is that, I was kind of saying this for the HomeKit cameras in general, The companies like Logitech and August and Canary and Public Ring, they want to use monthly subscriptions and to have recurring revenue in addition to selling you the hardware camera, you know, one-time $200 purchase. They want to have $10 a month from you as well to give you more features like an alert when motion is detected. And they've gone as far as to do, like, is a person detected? Is it an animal? Is it within, you know, perimeters of the view? You can get very specific, but a lot of these things require memberships because they want reoccurring revenue. That's the only reason. In HomeKit, natively, you can set up alerts when motion is detected. You can't say, like, by when it's people or ignore, you know, I don't think you can ignore, like, parts of the view. So it's not as granular. But if you just wanted a doorbell camera that alerted you when someone was there, you could do that through HomeKit. And I think that the companies want to sell you a subscription membership with a fee for that functionality. So that's my theory. And I think it also applies to other HomeKit cameras that we've seen. So, yeah. By the way, I just got an email. August does not have any comment at this time. We recommend you reach out to Apple for more information. Okay, thanks. So,
well, we have reached out to Apple, so.
Yeah, we have. So, yeah, there we go. So, I don't imagine there's any, like, API change. Like, I think Apple would still welcome the hardware to be there. In fact, like, their big image for HomeKit that you used is a doorbell camera view of, like, a
person. Yeah, I don't think there's any, like, policy thing here. Like, we're never going to do doorbells. It's just stuff takes time. This is getting delayed and delayed and delayed, so... We've taken it off the website finally, just for the time being.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is too bad because, like, that view that they show for HomeKit, you know, where they have the delivery person and then there's, like, an intercom button right there in the same alert. Like, that's nice. We can't get it yet. So, yeah. Oh, well. Also, let's talk about a few things from this week's beta refresh. So we got beta 4 of macOS Mojave, iOS 12, tvOS 12, and watchOS 5. And a pretty small week, 2 weeks for the iOS 12 change. We just got mainly more activity app stickers and messages, which are nice. These are the first. These are the stickers are without unlocking an achievement with the Apple Watch. I think you need an Apple Watch to have the activity app, but then you get all these nice stickers that you can use in messages. That's cool. And then the next thing is the walkie-talkie app on the Apple Watch. This is kind of a touchy spot for me to discuss because we got so much feedback from our talk about that, right? Like a lot of email, a lot of Twitter interaction. Because I think we both agree that walkie-talkie was just too aggressive in how it reaches you. That yep. if you're available, it makes sense to receive an alert. But if you do not disturb, you probably shouldn't receive an alert because you've said don't disturb me. But then it still auto-played the message, chirped, and then auto-played the message. So now that they've changed it, tell me what's different now.
So now if you're muted... There's no change. It still comes through, which I think is weird, but there you go. But if you're on Do Not Disturb, it is silent. Thank goodness.
I think it's just like if you're unavailable. You get a message quietly that someone tried to reach you. They tell you who it was, but not what they said, and the message is gone forever. Even though you're still available. And they've changed the little yellow indicator on the watch face from being... persistent on every watch face that if you are available for walkie-talkie activity, you will always have a yellow icon for walkie-talkie on your watch face to now it's way more sane. It's that when you are available, the icon fades in and fades out, and then it's
gone. Get a little flash of it.
Yeah, you can tap it if you're really fast and then launch the walkie-talkie app, but it's no longer a launcher, really. Like, it's just there for a moment, and then it's gone. Other things like Now Playing are still persistent. I think location service, like if using maps, that would be persistent. Like, those are still launchers. Just like the workout app is one. But walkie-talkie is no longer that persistent. It's just a little gentle shimmer of the icon, and then it goes away. And I can
it's better. I still think they could just not have it there at all, because it kind of like distracts your eye now, where you've got like this flash of yellow at the top of the screen.
Yeah.
But it's better.
It's dramatically improved. Yep.
And I'm blaming it on us. It was our extensive criticism that caused Apple to fix this.
Well, I mean, it's our critique in one episode, fix in one beta, 1 month later. And that's a reasonable turnaround time. So thank you, people who listen. I think these are improvements for the best. I am more likely to leave walkie-talkie on now that it doesn't permanently tell me that it's on. And knowing that Do Not Disturb mode can quiet it down. Even though mute doesn't, I can live with that. It's reasonable. And then finally, in macOS Mojave, there is a new dynamic desktop wallpaper option, which in the previous beta, they had their own section for dynamic desktop wallpapers, and there's only one at the time, which is the sand dunes changes between night and day. And it was like, okay, it's on a section. Will that be like on iOS, where they have dynamic wallpapers that never change? And as of this beta, there is a new option, which is called Solo Gradient. And if you've seen those like single color but like gradient changes wallpapers on iOS, I think they're gone now, but they used to be included. Of like blue, navy blue, light blue to orange, for example, that's what it looks like. And it changes throughout the day to be darker blue, light white. And it's neat if you have the bottom, if you have the dock in the correct spot on the bottom of the Mac, then there's a cool color effect that you can see behind the dock that changes.
Yeah, I like it. It looks cool.
Yeah,
I'd probably pick the sand dune one though, because that's also very pretty.
Yeah, it's the new Solo Gradient one is it's really simple. Like I think it's like if you prefer to have like a solid color for your wallpaper, then this suits your needs. It's not a picture of something at all. Like it's just color. I think mine's bugged though, because I'm getting like bright blue at night with white at the bottom, and then like navy in the middle of the day with like orange, like it looks like sunset in the wrong, like opposite times of day. So
it's like 12 hours out of sync.
Yeah. Which may be like me changing the time on the Mac manually, like when we first discovered it, like, oh, what is it like in 6 hours? I changed it back, but I think it's a little bit bugged in the beta right now. But nice to say that there's at least two, and there could be more in the future. You know,
it's better than they've done on the iPhone. That's all I'll say about that.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can email us at happyhour@nfimatch.com. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Apollo Zach, and Benjamin, you are
BZA Mayo.
And with that, we will be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.